Chapter 7. The smell of gumbo hung inside the house in thick green ropes, like something you could swing on to get across the kitchen. I set my suitcase on the beige rug and walked down the hallway to Mother's bedroom. I called out, "Mother? It's me, Jessie." And my voice sounded grainy and tired. She was not in her bed. The blanket was thrown back and the white sheets were wadded up in a mess, as if children had gone berserk jumping up and down on them. The bathroom door was shut, and fluorescent light leaked out from the bottom edge. As I waited for her to come out, I stretched my achy shoulders and neck. A pair of worn-out terry cloth slippers had been tossed upside down on the rug, which was beige like its sibling in the living room. Mother did not believe in unbeige rugs, or in walls or curtains in any color other than white, cream, and ivory. She did believe in green paint outside, but inside, things had to be more or less the color of tap water. The color of a life bled completely out. I regarded the old-fashioned dressing table with the gathered skirt. Was it beige or was it white with a case of old age? In the center of the dresser, Mother's ceramic Madonna had a chubby Jesus hoisted onto her hip and a look of postpartum depression about her. Beside it was a photograph of my father on his boat. The water was navy blue and traveled behind him forever. I was not thinking about how noiseless Mother was behind the bathroom door. I was preoccupied with the sense of wading back into her life, into this room, swimming in the contradictions she always stirred in me, the tangle of love and loathing. I scanned the bedside table, her old red-beaded rosary, two prescription bottles, a roll of gauze, tape, scissors, a digital clock. I realized I was looking for the mayonnaise jar. It was nowhere in the room. "Mother?" I tapped on the bathroom door. Silence loomed back, and then a thin, sticky anxiety seeped from behind the door. I turned the knob and stepped inside. There was nothing but the minuscule bathroom. Empty. I walked into the kitchen, a room so changeless it seemed magically frozen in place. Entering it was like strolling back into the 1950s. The same can opener attached to the wall, the canisters with the rooster motif, copper tea kettle, tin bread box, dingy teaspoons mounted on a wooden rack. The wall clock beside the refrigerator was a black cat with a swinging tail pendulum. The immortal Felix. I expected to see Mother sitting at the formica table eating gumbo. But this room, too, was empty. I hurried through the dining room, checked the two extra bedrooms, Mike's and my old rooms. She had to have been here while Hepzibah was in the house. What, 10 minutes ago? I returned to the kitchen and looked up Hepzibah's number, but as I reached for the phone, I noticed the back door ajar. Grabbing a flashlight, I stepped onto the back stairs, swinging the beam across the yard. The sash to Mother's blue bathrobe lay in a coil on the bottom step. I went down and retrieved it. The wind had picked up. It took the sash right out of my hand. I watched it jerk and flail into the darkness. Where would she go? I remembered the time Dee, 5 years old, had slipped away from me in North Lake Mall, the seizure of panic I'd felt, followed by an almost preternatural calm, by some voice inside telling me the only way to find Dee was to think like her. I'd sat on a bench and thought like Dee, then walked straight to the children's shoe store, where I'd found her among the Sesame Street tennis shoes, trying to lace Bert and Ernie onto her small feet. I knew only one thing Mother loved the way Dee had loved Bert and Ernie. I found the path that led to the monastery at the back of the yard. It wasn't a long path, but it twisted through overarching wax myrtle and sweet bay and snags of dewberry vines. The monks had cut a crude opening for Mother in the monastery wall, so she wouldn't have to go all the way around to the entrance when she came to cook for them. They called it Nell's Gate. Mother, of course, ate that up. She'd told me about it at least 50 times. As I stepped through it, I shouted her name. I heard an animal of some sort rustle in the brush, then a whippoorwill, and when the wind died momentarily, the distant pitch and tumble of the ocean, that endless percussion it makes. Mother had worn a foot trail to the main path that ran between the cloister and the monks' cottages. I followed it, pausing once or twice to call out to her. But the wind seemed to bat my voice right back at me. The moon had risen. It hung low out over the marsh, a startling orb of glassy light. When I saw the back of the cloister enclave, I cut off the flashlight and began to run. Everything flowed past me. The little markers with the stations of the cross, the plumes of mist, the sea wind, and the knotty ground. I swept past the stucco house where the monks made their nets, the sign over its door reading, Fortuna, Maria, Retia Nostra. Bless, Mary, our nets. The statue of Saint Sinara was in an enclosed garden beside the church. I stepped through the gate into a dense haven of rose bushes, their limbs bare and reaching, forming candelabra shadows against the far wall. The monks had designed the garden with Saint Sinara's statue in the center, and six evenly spaced paths leading into her. She looked like the hub of a magnificent floral wheel. I'd played here as a child. While Mother slaved in the monastery kitchen, I would come out here and pull dozens of rose heads off their stems, filling a sweet grass basket with petals, a whole mishmash of colors, which I disposed of in secret ceremonies, tossing them into the marsh behind the church, around the trunks of certain venerable bearded oaks, and onto the seat of the mermaid chair, for some reason that being the most honored spot. It was my funeral game, a solemn play I'd indulged in after my father died. The petals were his ashes, and I'd thought what I was doing was saying goodbye. But it may have been just the opposite, that I was trying to hold on to him, tuck him in private places only I knew. I would find the petals weeks later, lumps of brown, dried rose chips. The night seemed paler now, as if the wind had blown some of the darkness out of it. I stood still, letting my eyes roam across the tops of the rose bushes, along the paths plowed with moonlight. There was no sign of my mother. I wish then I'd called Hepzibah and Cat instead of dashing over here, wasting all this time. I'd just been so sure she would be here, much sure than I'd been about Dee and the shoe store. Mother had made herself the keeper of the statue about the same time she'd started work in the kitchen. She often trudged out here with a bucket of soapy water to wash the bird shit off it, and four times a year she waxed it with a paste that smelled like orange peel and limes. She came here to pour out the various and sundry torments of her life, instead of going into the church and telling them to God. Sinara was practically a nobody in the hierarchical world of saints, but Mother believed in her. She loved to recount the story of my birth as proof of Sinara's potency, how I was turned backward in her womb and became stuck during the delivery. She'd prayed to Sinara, who'd promptly flipped me upside down, and I'd wriggled head first into the world. Out here in the middle of the garden, the statue appeared like a stamen protruding from the center of a huge, winter-blighted flower. It occurred to me that the saint had presided the same way over my childhood, her shadow hovering above the emptiness that had come when I was nine. The worst punishment Mike and I ever received had come because we'd dressed the statue in a two-piece swimsuit, sunglasses, and a blonde wig. We'd cut the bottom of the suit in half and pinned it together around Sinara's hips. Some monks had thought the getup was funny, but Mother had cried over our disrespect and sentenced us to write the Agnus Dei 500 times a day for a solid week. Lamb of God, who takest away the sins of the world, have mercy on us. Instead of being contrite, I'd merely felt confused about it all, as if I'd betrayed Sinara and liberated her at the same time. As I stood near the back of the garden, trying to think what to do now that Mother plainly wasn't here, I heard a thin scratching sound drift from the general vicinity of Sonara's statue, like a small bird raking the ground for grubs and insects. I came up behind the statue, and there was Mother, sitting on the ground with the mayonnaise jar, her white hair a neon splotch in the dark. She wore her practical navy coat over a long chenille bathrobe and sat with her legs splayed out in front of her, the way a child might sit in a sandbox. She was digging in the dirt with her left hand, using what looked like a stainless steel soup ladle. The bandage on her right hand appeared the size of a child's baseball glove and was speckled with dirt. She didn't see me. She was utterly absorbed in what she was doing. I stared at her silhouette for several seconds, my relief at finding her shifting into some fresh, new dread. I said, "Mother, it's me, Jessie." She reared back with a sudden jerk, and the ladle fell into her lap. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph," she cried. "You scared me to death. What are you doing here?" I sank down beside her. "I'm out here looking for you," I replied, trying to sound natural and unalarmed. I even tried to smile.
"Well, you found me," she said, then picked up the ladle and resumed work on the mouse hole she'd made at the base of the statue.
"All right, we've established what I'm doing here. Now, what are you doing here?" I asked.
"It doesn't really concern you."
When I'd found Dee that day in the shoe store, I'd grabbed her by the shoulders, wanting to scream at her for scaring me. And the same irrational anger flared in me now. I wanted to shake my mother till her teeth tumbled out. "How can you say that?" I demanded. "Hepzibah must have told you I was here, and you took off before I could even get into the house. You scared me to death, too."
"Oh, for heaven's sake, I didn't mean to scare you. I just needed to take care of this."
This? What was this? I turned on the flashlight and directed a beam of light onto the mayonnaise jar. Her dismembered finger lay inside it. It looked very clean, and the nail appeared to have been filed. Lifting the jar, level with my nose, I could see the shriveled edge of skin at the severed end with a piece of white bone protruding. A sick feeling passed through me, similar to my nausea that morning. I closed my eyes and didn't speak, and Mother went on scraping at the cold ground. At last I said, "I don't know what you're doing out here, but you're not well, and you need to get up and come back to the house with me." I felt suddenly bleary with exhaustion.
"What do you mean I'm not well?" she'd said. "I'm perfectly well."
"Really? Since when is purposely cutting off your finger considered perfectly well?" I sighed. "Jesus Christ." She whirled toward me then.
"Why don't you call on someone you know?"
she said in a scalding tone.
"Nobody asked you to come back."
"Cat asked me."
"Cat needs to mind her own business,"
I snorted.
"Well, fat chance of that."
I heard the beginnings of a laugh down in her throat, a rare melting sound I hadn't heard in so long, and for some reason it knocked my little wall of anger flat. Sliding over so that our shoulders touched, I laid my hand on top of hers, the one still coiled around the spoon, and I thought maybe she would jerk it away, but she didn't. I felt the tiny stick bones in her hand, the soft lattice of veins. "I'm sorry. For everything," I said. "I really am." She turned and looked at me, and I saw that her eyes were brimming, reflecting like mirrors. She was the daughter, and I was the mother. We had reversed the natural order of things, and I couldn't fix it, couldn't reverse it. The thought was like a stab. I said, "Tell me, okay? Tell me why you did this to yourself." She said, "Joe, your father," and then her jaw slumped down as if his name bore too much weight for her mouth. She looked at me and tried again.
Father Dominic, she said, but her voice trailed off. What about Father Dominic? Nothing, she said, and refused to go on. I couldn't imagine what sort of anguish was stoppered inside her, or what Father Dominic had to do with anything. I didn't get my ashes today, she said. And I realized I hadn't either. It was the first Ash Wednesday service I had missed since my father died. Picking up the ladle, she scooped at the ground. The dirt's too hard. Are you trying to bury your finger? I asked. I just want to put it in a hole and cover it up. If your mother says fish fly, just say yes, ma'am. Fish fly. I took the digging tool from her. All right, then. I gouged out the opening she'd made at the base of the statue until the hole was about 6 inches deep. She unscrewed the jar and pulled out her finger. She held it up, and both of us stared at it. Mother with a kind of dark reverence on her face, and me, subdued, almost numb. We are burying my mother's finger, I told myself. We are out here in a garden burying a finger, and it has something to do with my father and with Father Dominic. I think we could have lit the tip of her finger and let it burn like a taper, and the moment wouldn't have seemed any stranger to me. As Mother laid her finger in the hole, she turned it knuckle up and brushed the fingers on her good hand along the length of it, before covering it with the spooned-out dirt. I watched it disappear, an image in my head of a small mouth opening and closing in the earth, swallowing a part of my mother that she could no longer endure. The ground was spattered with dried rose petals, as if all the red flames had fallen off their candles. I raked up a papery handful. Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return, I said, and pressed a petal onto Mother's forehead, then one onto mine. So now you have your ashes. Mother smiled at me. The garden became absolutely still and quiet, yet neither of us heard him approaching until he was almost beside us. Mother and I both looked up at the same moment and saw him step from behind the statue, materializing out of the shadows in his long robe, very tall, his face shining in the bright-lit night. Chapter 8. I scrambled to my feet, while Mother continued to sit on the ground. The monk looked down at her. He had to be at least 6'1" or 2", and had the lean, possessed look of an athlete, a swimmer, perhaps, or a long-distance runner. Nell, he said, are you all right? He didn't ask what we were doing sitting on the ground in the dark with a soup ladle, an empty Hellman's jar, and a fresh mound of dirt. I'm fine, Mother told him. I came to see the saint, that's all. He pushed back the cowl from his head, smiling at her. Such an easy, infectious smile, and I saw that his hair was dark and impeccably short. He glanced at Mother's bandaged hand. I'm sorry about your injury. We prayed for you at Mass. He turned toward me, and we stared at each other for several seconds. In the sharp light of the moon, I noticed that his eyes were pale blue and his face deeply tanned. There was an irresistible look of boyishness about him, but something else, too, that struck me as serious, intense. Brother Thomas, he said, smiling again, and I felt an odd catch in my chest. I'm Nell's daughter, I replied, Jessie Sullivan. Later, I would revisit that encounter again and again. I would tell myself that when I met him, all the dark little wicks in the cells of my body lifted up in the knowledge that here he was, the one you wait for. But I don't know if that was really true, or if I only came to believe that it was. I'm sure I've burdened our first meeting with too much imagining, but I did feel that catch in my chest. I saw him, and something happened. Mother struggled to get to her feet, and he offered her his hand, tugging her up, and didn't let go until she had her balance.
"Who's cooking your meals?" she asked him. "Brother Timothy." "Oh, not him," she exclaimed. "I think he's a very good refectorian. He does a good job setting out the dishes and filling the milk pitchers, but he can't cook."
"Of course he can't," said Thomas. "That's why the abbot chose him. He made a very mysterious casserole today. We've all been forced into a Lenten fast."
Mother gave him a playful shove with her good hand, and I caught a glimpse of the affection the monks had for her. It surprised me. I'd thought of her as the nettlesome monastery mascot, but perhaps she was more to them than that.
"Don't worry," she told him. "I'll be back in the kitchen in a few days."
"No, you won't," I said too abruptly. "It could take weeks for your hand to heal."
Her eyes flared at me. Thomas said, "Weeks? We'll all be starved by then. We'll be sanctified and purified from fasting, but we'll be completely emaciated."
"I'll bring Jessie with me," Mother said. "She'll help me do the cooking."
"No, no. You take your time getting well," he said to her. "I'm only teasing you."
"We need to get back," I muttered. I followed them through the wrought iron gate, down the path toward the house, Thomas holding Mother's elbow, guiding her along. She was chattering to him. I held the jar and ladle in one hand and aimed the flashlight with the other. He walked with us all the way to Nell's gate. Mother paused before slipping through it.
"Give me a blessing," she said.
He looked unnerved by the request, and I thought, what an uncomfortable monk he is. He raised his right hand over her head and traced a clumsy cross in the air. It seemed to satisfy her, and she strode off across her yard toward the house. I stepped through the gate and looked at him from the other side of the wall. It was made of brick and came to my waist. "Thanks for walking back with us," I said. "You didn't have to." He smiled again, and the lines on either side of his mouth deepened. "It was no trouble. I was glad to." "You must be wondering what Mother and I were doing out there." I set the jar and the dirt-crusted ladle on top of the wall, then put the flashlight down too, pointing the stream of light off into the trees. I don't know why I suddenly felt compelled to explain things, probably out of embarrassment. "She wasn't just visiting Saint Sonara. I found her on her knees beside the statue, trying to bury her finger in the dirt. She was so bent on doing it that I ended up digging the hole for her myself. I have no idea whether that was a good idea or not, whether I was helping her or making things worse." He shook his head a little.
"I probably would have done the same thing if I'd found her there," he said.
"Do you think she was offering her finger to Saint Sonara?" "To be honest, I don't know anything anymore when it comes to my mother." He let his gaze settle on me, the same absorbing stare as before.
"You know, a lot of us at the monastery feel like we should have seen what was coming. We're with Nell every single day, and not one of us had a clue she was so..." I thought he was going to say crazy or demented.
"Desperate," he said.
"Desperate is putting it mildly," I told him. "You're right. I suppose it is. At any rate, we feel bad about it."
There was a moment of silence when the chilled air rose up around us. I looked back for Mother. Yellow light poured out of the windows, drenching the air around the house. She had already climbed the back stairs and disappeared into the kitchen. I realized I didn't want to go inside. Arching my neck, I looked up at the sky, at the milky smear of stars, feeling a momentary sensation of floating, of becoming unmoored from my life. When I looked back down, I saw his strong, browned hands resting on the bricks inches from my own and wondered what it would feel like to touch them.
"Look, if you need anything, if we can help somehow, call us," he said.
You're only a wall away, I responded, and patted the bricks, trying to make a little joke, to ease how self-conscious I suddenly felt. He laughed and pulled his cowl up over his head. His face disappeared into the dark pocket. I gathered up the objects on the wall, turned quickly, and crossed the lawn, hurrying, not looking back. Chapter 9. The next morning when I woke in my old room, I realized I'd dreamed about Brother Thomas. I lay still, while the room filled with light, and the whole thing came back to me. How we were floating on the ocean, lying side by side on an inflatable raft. I was wearing a swimsuit, something suspiciously like the two-piece suit Mike and I dressed St. Sonara in all those years ago. Brother Thomas had on his black robe with the cowl pulled over his head. He rolled toward me, coming up on his elbow and gazing down at my face. The water moved under us with a lulling rhythm, and there were pelicans diving, scooping up fish. He pushed his cowl back and smiled in that same captivating way he had in the garden, a smile I found intensely sexual. Touching my cheek with his hand, he said my name, Jesse. He said it in his deep voice, and I felt the curve of my back lift up. His fingers slid beneath me and unhooked the top of my bathing suit. His mouth was at my ear, the heat of his breath rushing in and out. I turned to kiss him, but in that unexpected way of dreams, I found myself suddenly sitting up on the raft in a panic, with the sense of losing all track of time. Around us, there was nothing but vast, rolling water, as far as I could see. I rarely remembered dreams. For me, they were frustrating mirages that hovered on the edge of waking, then melted conspicuously the moment I opened my eyes. But this one had stayed with me in grand detail. In my mind, I could still see the pearls of seawater beating up on the black wool of Brother Thomas's robe from the splash of the pelicans. The burning blue look in his eyes, his fingers sliding beneath me. I wondered for a second how Hugh, or even Dr. Ilg, would analyze a dream like this, but decided I didn't want to know. I sat up, letting my feet poke around at the edge of the bed for my slippers. I raked my fingers through my hair, pulling at several tangles, listening for sounds of Mother, but the house drifted in silence. Mother and I had both fallen into bed last night, too tired to talk. The thought of instigating a conversation with her today made me want to slide back under the covers and make myself into a little curl. What would I say to her? Do you have plans to sever any more body parts? It sounded crass, horrible, but that's what I really wanted to know. Whether she was a danger to herself. Whether she needed committing to some place that could take care of her. I shuffled to the kitchen and poked around in a cabinet until I found the bag of Maxwell House. I had to make the coffee in a 20-year-old electric percolator with a fraying cord. I wondered if she'd even heard about Mr. Coffey's. As the contraption bloop-blooped, I crept to Mother's door and listened. Her snores wafted through the room. Her insomnia, it seemed, had disappeared with her finger. I went back to the kitchen. The room was dim with waking light, the air chilly. Striking a match, I lit the space heater, listening to the gas flames pop with the same little blue sounds as always. Loading two slices of bread into the toaster, I watched the coils down inside glow red and thought about Thomas, the monk, and how odd that whole encounter had been. How he'd appeared in the garden out of nowhere. I thought of the two of us out there talking, the severe way his gaze had entered me, the flutter in my body, and then I'd had the kind of dream I'd heard Hugh speak of, in which some great enigmatic plane flies through your sleep, opening its bombardier doors, dropping a small, ticking dream. The toast popped up. I poured the coffee. Drank it black while nibbling the bread. The heater had turned the room into a Carolina cypress swamp.
I got up and snapped it off. I couldn't explain to myself why I was thinking these things. Thinking about Brother Thomas, a monk, and in that way, that incendiary way. I imagined Hugh back home, and a terrible vulnerability took over. It was as if the most carefully guarded place in me had been suddenly abandoned, left wide open and assailable, the place that told me who I was. I got up and walked into the living room, that feeling from the dream returning, the awful sense of losing my moorings. On one of the walls, Mother had as many as 15 or 20 photographs, framed in a disorganized mess, some with that dingy, sepia look around the edges. Most were old school pictures of me and Mike. Hideous hairdos, half-shut eyes, wrinkled white blouses, braces. Dee called it the wall of embarrassment. The only photo up there taken after the 60s was one of Hugh, Dee, and me in 1970, when Dee was a baby. I stared with resolve at the three of us, remembering how Hugh had rigged the delayed timer on the camera, and we'd posed on the sofa, tucking Dee between us, her small, sleepy face wedged under our chins. The same evening we'd taken the picture, we'd made love for the first time after Dee's birth. We were supposed to wait 6 weeks before having sex. It happened, though, 2 days early. I'd passed by the nursery and seen Hugh leaning over Dee's crib. Even though she was sound asleep, he was singing something to her very softly. An amber light was spread across the ceiling from the nightlight, sifting down to sit on his shoulders like a furring of dust. Heat shot through my body, something potent and sexual. It was the tenderness in Hugh that hit me so forcibly. The sight of him loving her without anyone knowing. I felt suddenly possessed by the intimacy we'd had, creating her, the thought of her flesh forming out of the things we'd done in the next room. I went and slid my arms around his waist. Pressing my cheek against his back, I felt him turn to me. His hands made slow circles over my body. He whispered, "We have 2 more days to wait." And when I said I couldn't wait, he picked me up and carried me to bed. Loving him had seemed different, more unbridled, deeper, more purely felt. It had something to do with Dee, as if Hugh and I belonged together in some new way, and the thought seemed measureless and intoxicating to me. Afterward, as we lay across the bed, Dee woke up crying. While I fed her, Hugh set up the camera. I was wearing a peach-colored housecoat. I hadn't even gotten it buttoned up all the way. And Hugh, you should see his face in the photo, how content and amused and clandestine it looked. The picture always stirred a secretive feeling in me, followed by a little flourish of happiness spreading open like an exotic paper fan in the center of my chest. I stood there and waited for the feeling to come. The event seemed so long ago, like some glorious ship inside a bottle. I did not know how it got in there, or how to get it out. I picked up the phone and started dialing. "Hello," Hugh said, and his voice seemed to rise under me like solid ground. "It's me," I said. "I was just thinking about you. Are you all right? I tried to call last night. No one answered." "Oh, great. I was going to have to buy a Mr. Coffee and an answering machine." "We were at the monastery," I said. "I found Mother over there burying her finger." "As in, digging a hole in the ground and covering it up?" "That's what I mean." There was a long pause. "I think that actually might be a good sign, at least for the moment," he said. "It could mean she's settling down, that her obsession is going underground, so to speak." I lifted my eyebrows, intrigued by this, almost hopeful. "You think so?"
"Could be," he said. "But Jessie, she still needs professional help. She should have been admitted to the psychiatric unit. With time, the pattern could start all over again. I stretched the phone cord over to the table and sat down.
You mean she might cut off another finger?
Well, yes. Or it could be something completely different. Obsessions like this are ego-dystonic, just random thoughts. There was a little tapping noise, and I knew he was on the portable phone at the bathroom sink, shaving as we talked.
But I don't think cutting off a finger was random. I really think it relates to something particular, I said.
Oh, I doubt that, he said, dismissing the idea.
Dismissing me. I sank back in the chair, letting out a sigh. I'll talk to her today and see if...
I suppose that won't hurt, but I was thinking, I'm going to come to the island this weekend. You shouldn't handle this by yourself.
He'd interrupted me.
No, I don't think it's a good idea for you to come, I said. I think she would be more apt to... It's too complicated for you to handle by yourself, Jesse.
It was, of course.
It would be like my sitting down to solve a math equation that was 2 feet long. What was going on inside her was a conundrum so far beyond me it was pathetic. I was considering saying to him, yes, yes, you, come fix things. But it still felt wrong to me.
Part of it was the feeling that I, the non-psychiatrist in the family, really could help Mother better than he could. That I could figure things out better by myself. And maybe, too, I didn't want Hugh here. I wanted this time for myself, to be on my own. Was that so awful? I told myself it had nothing to do with the monk and what had happened the night before. I mean, nothing had happened. No, this was about me for once, following my own idea about something. Later, though, I would wonder about that. Are motives ever that clear?
I stood up. I said, I will handle it. I don't want you to come. It came out angrier than I'd intended. Jesus, he said. You don't have to shout at me. I looked back toward Mother's bedroom, hoping I hadn't awakened her. Maybe I feel like shouting, I said. I didn't know why I was picking a fight.
For God's sake, I was just trying to help. What's wrong with you?
Nothing, I snapped. Nothing's wrong with me.
Well, apparently there is, he said, raising his voice.
What you mean is, if I don't need your help, there's something wrong with me.
Now you're being ridiculous, he said, and his tone was lacerating. Did you hear me? You're being ridiculous.
And I hung up. I simply hung up. I refilled my coffee cup and sat with my hands wrapped around it. They were shaking a little. I waited for the phone to ring, for him to call me back. When he didn't, I became anxious, filled with that strange turbulence that rises when you begin to wash up on the island of your own little self, and you don't see how you could ever sustain yourself there. After a while, I bent down and peered under the table. The crucifix was still nailed beneath it. The storm tent Jesus.
Chapter 10. That morning when I had changed the bandage on Mother's hand, I had to look away from the wound more than once. Mother sat in the brown wicker chair at her dressing table, while I cleaned the skin around the sutures with hydrogen peroxide and dabbed antibiotic ointment on a sterile pad. The cut was just below her knuckle on the pointing finger, as she always referred to it. I kept thinking what a violent burst of energy it would have taken to bring the cleaver down with enough force to sever the bone. She winced when I placed the pad over the tender, swollen nub. I glanced at the photograph of my father, wondering what he would have thought of her now, the dreadful turn she'd taken after his death.
what he would have thought of her slicing off a finger. Mother turned and looked at the photo, too.
I know what I did seems crazy to you.
Was she talking to him or to me?
I just wish you'd help me understand why you had to, I said.
She tapped the glass on the frame with her fingernail. It made a clicking sound in the room.
This picture was made the day he started his charter business.
I'd been 5 at the time. I didn't remember him as a shrimper, only as captain of the Jess C. Before he'd bought the boat, he'd worked for Shem Watkins, scrimping for shrimp, he'd said. He would take one of Shem's trawlers out for a week at a time and come back with 4,000 pounds of shrimp in the hold. But all he'd wanted was to run his own business, be his own boss, with the freedom to be out on the water when he wanted and home with his family when he wanted. He'd come up with an inshore fishing charter idea, saved and bought his Chris craft. 4 years later, it had exploded. He said his religion was the sea, that it was his family. He told Mike and me stories about a sea kingdom ruled by a gang of ruthless mud snails and the brave keyhole limpets who tried to overthrow them. His imagination was ingenious. He told us we could make wands out of stingray barbs and by waving them a certain way cause the waves to sing Dixie, something that had occupied us for fruitless hours. If we dreamed of a great egret, he said we would find its feathers beneath our pillow the next morning. I woke up more than once to white feathers in my bed, though I could never recall the egret dream that had brought them. And, of course, the ne plus ultra of all his stories, how he'd seen an entire pod of mermaids one dawn, swimming to his boat. I could not remember a single time he'd attended Mass, but he was the one who'd first taken me to the monastery to see the mermaid chair, who told me the story behind it. I think he'd only pretended to be a reprobate. Though he refused to share Mother's religion, he seemed to admire it. Back then, she was not pathological about it. Sometimes I think he married her because of her boundless capacity for faith. How she could swallow every preposterous doctrine, dogma, and story the church came up with. Maybe her faith in the church made up for his lack of it. My mother and father made a peculiar couple, Walt Whitman and Joan of Arc. But it had worked. They had adored each other. I was sure of that. Mother turned away from his photograph and waited as I finished winding the gauze bandage around her hand. She was wearing her blue chenille robe minus the belt. She gathered the collar up around her neck, then let her hand drift down to the drawer, the one with all the religious bilge. She fingered the handle. I wondered if the clipping about his death was still in there. Why had I given him the pipe? Dad and I had seen it one day in Caw Caw General, and he'd admired it. He picked it up and pretended to take a puff.
I've always wanted to be the kind of man who smoked a pipe, he said.
I'd taken every cent of my Fiddler Crab money and bought it for him for Father's Day. Mother had told me not to, that she didn't want him smoking a pipe. I bought it anyway. She'd never said a word to me about its being the cause of the fire. I tore a piece of adhesive tape and fastened the end of the gauze to her wrist. She started to get up, but I knelt in front of her chair and placed my hands on her knees. I didn't know where to start, but I'd taken this on. I'd banished Hugh, and now it was all mine. As I knelt there, my belief that I could handle it by myself was starting to break apart. Mother stared straight into my eyes. Her lower lids drooped down into deep curves, exposing their small pink linings. She looked timeless, older than her years. I said, "Last night in the garden, you mentioned Father Dominic, remember?" She shook her head. Her good hand lay in her lap, and I took it in mine, touching the tips of her fingers. "I asked you why you did this to your finger, and you brought up Dad, and then you mentioned Father Dominic. Did he have something to do with your cutting off your finger?" She gave me a blank look.
Did he give you the idea that you should do some kind of penance? Something like that?
The blankness turned to exasperation.
No, of course not.
But cutting off your finger was penance, wasn't it?
Her eyes darted away from my face.
Please, Mother, we need to talk about it.
She pressed her teeth into her bottom lip and seemed to consider my question. I watched her touch a strand of her hair and thought how yellowish it looked.
I can't talk about Dominic, she said finally.
But why not?
I can't. That's all.
She picked up a prescription bottle and walked to the door.
I need to take my pain pill, she said,
and vanished into the hall, leaving me on my knees beside her dresser. Chapter 11. I spent the morning on a cleaning campaign, determined to be helpful. I changed the sheets on Mother's bed, did the laundry, and scrubbed things that hadn't been touched in years. The bathroom grout, the Venetian blinds, the coils on the back of the refrigerator. I went into the pantry and threw away everything that had expired. 2 huge bags of stuff. I dragged her rusting golf cart out of the garage and cranked it up to see if it worked. And eyeing the grimy bathtub grotto, I hooked up the garden hose and gave it a good spray cleaning. Through all of this, I thought about Mother's refusal to talk about my father's death, her strange mention of Father Dominic. I thought, on and off, about Brother Thomas, too. I didn't mean to. He simply wormed his way in. At one point, I'd found myself poised under the exposed light bulb in the pantry, holding a 28-ounce can of tomatoes, and realized I'd been replaying some moment with him from the night before. The day was warm, the sun bearing down with a throbbing winter brightness. Mother and I ate lunch on the front porch, balancing trays on our laps, eating the gumbo neither of us could face the night before. I tried to draw her out again about Dominic, but she sat there shuttered tightly. Looking for some way, any way to reach her, I asked if she'd like to call Dee at college, and she shook her head. I gave up then. I listened to her spoon scratch the bottom of her bowl, and I knew I would have to find out about Dominic some other way. I doubted she would ever talk to me about anything, that we'd get to the root of things, as Hugh had called it. I hated that he was probably right. It made me determined. After lunch, she lay down on her bed and took a nap. It was as if she were making up now for all the lost sleep. While she dozed, I slipped into her room to get the name of her doctor from the prescription bottle, telling myself I should call him. But I never even copied it down. I stood gazing at her dresser, the ceramic Mary with the plump Jesus planted on her hip. The drawer was right there. I pulled it out. The wood scraped, and I looked back at the bed. She didn't move. The inside of the drawer brimmed with holy cards, rosaries, a prayer book, old photographs of Dee. I groped through all her cherished clutter as quietly as I could, exactly the way I'd done when I was a child. Was the clipping still here? My heart was beating very fast. Near the back, my fingers bumped against something slender and hard. I knew what it was before I pulled it out. I froze for a second or two, the air bristling around me, bracing myself before I pulled it up. It was the pipe I'd given my father. I glanced again at Mother, then held it up to the light slanting through the window, and nothing made sense to me. My knees felt like sponges, wet and squishy. It was impossible to keep standing. I sat down on the chair. How could the pipe be in the drawer? When had she put it here? It should have been at the bottom of the ocean along with the Jess Sea, along with my father. I played it out in my mind so many times, the way it must have happened. Joseph Dubois, standing on his boat in the last stain of darkness, looking east to where the sun had just lifted its shiny forehead over the water. He often took his boat out then to greet the dawn. That was his phrase for it.
Mike and I would come to breakfast, and Dad would not be there, and we would say, "Is Dad still greeting the dawn?" We thought it was a common thing people did, like getting their hair cut. He would go alone on these excursions, smoke his pipe unperturbed, and watch the sea become a membrane of rolling light. I'd pictured him on the last morning of his life, tapping his pipe on the rail. Have you ever seen how sparks fly from the bowl of a pipe? How far they travel? He taps his pipe, and unknown to him, the fuel line is leaking. One ember, 100 times smaller than a moth, flies onto a drop of gas in the well near the engine. There is a pop, a puff of flame. The fire leaps from puddle to puddle like a stone skipping water. It lunges and crackles, and I always imagine that this is the moment he turns. Just as the flames slam into the gas tank, the moment when everything blazes and bursts apart. I'd envisioned it this way so often that I couldn't fathom it happening any other way. And everyone had said as much. The police, the newspaper, the entire island. I closed my eyes. I felt that the centerpiece of my history had been dug up and exposed as a complete and utter fiction. It left a gaping place I couldn't quite step over. I was gripping the pipe almost painfully. I relaxed my hand. Bending over, I smelled the bowl of it, and it was like smelling him. Everything began to rearrange itself then. It wasn't the pipe that had caused the fire. I sat at the dresser for several minutes while Mother slept across the room, and I let the knowledge pour over me. I was not to blame. Chapter 12. I took the pipe to my room. I doubted she would go through the drawer and miss it. As I tucked it inside my purse, the relief I felt became full-blooded anger. I began to pace. I had an overwhelming impulse to shake Mother awake and ask why she'd let me grow up believing that my pipe had been the cause of everything. Mine had been a private blame. A heaviness no one sees. The kind that comes over you in dreams when you try to run but can barely move. I'd carried it like a weight in the shafts of my bones. And she'd let me. She had let me. Wait, that wasn't completely fair. Maybe Mother had thought I didn't know about the pipe. She tried to protect me from knowing, never speaking about it, hiding the clipping, and yet it didn't excuse her. It didn't. She would have to think in some small corner of her head that Mike and I would find out. The whole island had known about the pipe, for Christ's sake. How could she think we didn't? I could hear her breathing, an accordion rhythm that moved through the house. I didn't want to be there when she woke up. I scribbled a message and propped it on the kitchen table, saying I needed exercise, some air. Hepzibah's house was less than a mile away, down a crook of road that wound past the slave cemetery toward the Egret Rookery and then around to the beach. I could see it as I came around a curve, surrounded by wild tufts of evening primrose and seaside spurge. I knocked on her iridescent blue front door and waited. She didn't answer. I followed the path to the back of the house. The little screen porch was unlocked, so I stepped inside and rapped on the door to the kitchen, which was the same shiny indigo as the door in front. The blue was supposed to scare away the booger hag, a haunting spirit said to suck the soul out of you during the night. I doubted that Hepzibah believed in the booger hag, but she loved the old gullah ways. And just in case the blue doors didn't deter the hag, Hepzibah had planted a row of conch shells in her garden. On the side of the porch she had the so-called show-and-tell table set up as always, heaped with the ragged island treasures she'd spent most of her life collecting. I walked over to it, besieged by a sudden potent nostalgia. Mike and I had spent hours huddled over this table. It was piled with stocks of coral, crab claws, sea sponges, lightning whelks, shark eyes, augers, jackknife clams. Every lowly shell was remembered here, even broken ones. I picked up several chipped sand dollars, a starfish with two arms. Egret, heron, and ibis feathers were wedged among the objects, some standing straight up, as if they'd sprouted there. In the center of the table, elevated on a wooden box, was the elongated jawbone of an alligator. Naturally, this had been Mike's favorite object. Mine had been the chalk-white skull of a loggerhead turtle. In my imagination, I'd swum with that turtle through boundless water, down to the floor of the ocean and back. I poked around and discovered it stuffed among a pile of cockles. The night Hepzibah had found the skull, we were having the all-girls picnic on the beach. At least, that was how those occasions came to be known. I sat down now in an old rocker, holding the turtle skull in my hands, feeling the jolt of nostalgia again. I hadn't thought about the all-girls picnics in so long, since I was a girl. Cat had started them way back when both she and Mother were new brides, and Benny was only a toddler. Every May Day Eve, without fail, they'd gathered on Boneyard Beach. If it was raining, they'd hold the picnic the first clear night after that, though I recall that one year Cat got tired of waiting and set up a tarp. After Hepzibah hooked up with Mother and Cat, she joined the all-girls picnics, too, and then I got to come as soon as I could walk. They had stopped abruptly after Dad died. I remember the big feasts they made. Cat's crab cakes, Hepzibah's fine Hoppin' John, lots of wine. Mother usually brought her raisin bread pudding and a bag of Benny wafers in honor of Benny, who'd been named for the sesame cracker because Cat had eaten so many of them when she was pregnant. Everyone got May Day presents, usually bubble bath and Revlon nail polish, only flaming red allowed. But that wasn't what made me love those times. It was because on that one night of the year, Mother, Cat, and Hepzibah metamorphosed into completely different creatures. After we ate, they made a bonfire out of beechwood and danced while Benny and I sat on the sand over in the shadows and watched. Hepzibah beat her gullah drum, making a sound so old that after a while it seemed to be swelling up out of the earth and rolling in from the ocean. And Cat shook an old tambourine, filling the air with silver vibrations. At a certain point, something took them over, and they moved faster and faster, their shadows making inky smears in the firelight. The last year they held the picnic, the three of them waded into the water fully clothed, each holding a piece of thread that they'd yanked out of Mother's embroidered sweater. Benny and I stood with our toes touching the edge of the ocean and begged to come too. And Cat said, "No, this is just for us. Y'all stay back there." They walked out until the cold water creased their waists, and then they tied the three threads together. "Hurry up," they kept saying to one another, squealing when the waves lapped against them. I'd believed then, and I still believe now, that it was some ritual of friendship they'd concocted on the spot, thanks to the wine and the dizziness brought on by the dancing, and Mother's conveniently unraveling sweater. Cat flung their tied threads into the darkness, onto the waves, and they laughed. It was a voluptuous laughter, and mischievous, like children laughing. As they scampered back, Hepzibah found the turtle skull. She practically tripped over it coming out of the water. She stood above it with the waves foaming around her feet, Mother and Cat still giggling and carrying on. "Tie your mouth," Hepzibah said, switching into gullah, and everyone fell instantly silent. "Look what the ocean has sent," she said, and raised the skull out of the water, the ivory bone smooth and dripping, immaculate against the black night. I believe they all thought it was a sign of some kind. They had bound their lives together out there in the water, and suddenly a turtle skull miraculously washed up at their feet. For a long time after that, years and years, they'd passed the skull back and forth among them. I remembered it perched on our mantle for a while, before it would resurface on Cat's bookshelf or here on Hepzibah's table. It must have reminded them of those nights, of the knots in their threads. Now, sitting in the porch rocker, I rubbed the porous bone with my thumb and looked back at the blue door. Hepzibah obviously wasn't home. I got up and put the skull back on the table, and for a moment the table seemed like more than a distant slab of childhood memory. It felt like a living part of me. I'd known since I was 10 that I would leave the island. On the first Ash Wednesday after Dad's death, the moment the priest touched my forehead, I'd felt myself rise up out of that little smudge of ash with the determination of a phoenix. I will leave here, I told myself. I will fly away. After college, I'd rarely come back. And when I had, it had been with a dissociating arrogance. I hadn't even gotten married to Hugh here. The wedding had been in somebody's generic backyard garden in Atlanta, somebody we didn't even know that well. I thought about Cat teasing me, saying I'd forgotten the pluff mud from whence I'd come. And she'd been right. I'd done everything in my power to erase this place. The last thing I'd expected was to stand on Hepzibah's porch and feel a seizure of love for Egret Island. And not just for the island, but for the woman my mother had been, dancing around a fire. Something struck me then. I'd never done any of those things my mother had done. Never danced on a beach. Never made a bonfire. Never waded into the ocean at night with laughing women and tied my life to theirs. Chapter 13. The next morning I walked to the monastery. The sun, perky and yellow yesterday, had burrowed into a hole somewhere. Fog covered everything. It looked as if soup skim had formed over the entire island during the night. I wore my blue jeans and red coat and a clashing garnet baseball cap I'd found in the utility room with Carolina Gamecocks printed across the front. It was pulled low on my forehead, with my ponytail threaded through the hole in back. I walked the same path I'd taken a couple of nights earlier when I'd gone searching for Mother. I could smell the dense, primal odor of the marsh carried in by the fog, and it made me think of Brother Thomas. His face formed in my mind, and my insides gave a funny lurch. I was going to find Father Dominic. If I happened to run into Brother Thomas in the process, that was fine. But I told myself I wasn't going out of my way. Naturally, I had no idea what I would say to Dominic once I found him. I began to play with various strategies to learn what he knew about Mother's cutting off her finger. What if I talk to Dominic, really level with him, and he goes and tells Mother? I hadn't considered this. Whatever progress I'd made with her would evaporate then and there. She would probably send me packing again. I left her watching an old Julia Child cooking show on television. Mother loved Julia Child. I mean, loved her. She would say to me, "You think Julia Child is Catholic?" She would have to be, wouldn't she? Mother always copied down her recipes, especially anything with shrimp in it. If she wanted to cook one of Julia's shrimp dishes, she would simply send a monk out into the creek with a net. The monks hand-tied the nets, 6 and 8 footers, and sold them not only in the Low Country, but in seaside boutiques and fishing stores all along the East Coast. I'd seen one once in a shop on Cape Cod when Hugh and I were vacationing. It had been packaged with a fragment of scripture printed on the label, "Cast your net," from the Gospel of John. I believe the label had said, so there was a kind of mandate from God to buy it. "Shrewd marketers, aren't they?" Hugh had commented. They were priced at $75. Walking along, I remembered how the monks would sit on the shaved grass in the cloister square with strands of cotton twine and buckets of lead weights, their calloused hands moving back and forth in a beautiful, mindless rhythm. I used to think that custom-cast nets had to be the most exotic way on earth for monks to earn a living. But then, a couple of years ago, Dee had told me about a really cool monastery out west that sold hay to movie stars for their llamas. We'd had this whole discussion about which monastery had the more unusual or more auspicious occupation. We'd decided it had to be llama feeding. But still, cast nets were a long way from making fudge or rhubarb jelly. Mike had been a brilliant caster, holding the sides of the net in his hands, the top of it in his teeth, flinging it like a spinning frisbee into the air. It would sail up into the light, then plunge into the creek with a huge glump and a spray that rose like smoke rings off the surface. He would tug the net up and shake it, and the wiggling gray shrimp would spill around our feet. As I came through the last clump of trees, I glanced toward the cottages where the monks lived, the red tile roofs glowing pink in the murky light. I was, I realized, wishing for a glimpse of Brother Thomas, hoping that a crack would appear in the viscous morning and he would step out in the same ghostly way he had in the garden. Approaching the gate to the rose garden, I thought of Mother's finger in there and shuddered, remembering something I hadn't thought of in years. Mother and her milagros. When I was a teenager, she'd ordered them routinely from a cheesy Catholic catalog. They'd look like bracelet charms to me, except they were all severed body parts. Feet, hearts, ears, torsos, heads, hands. Eventually, I figured out that they were offerings, little prayers in the shape of the petitioner's afflictions. When Mother thought she had a cataract, she'd left an eye milagro at Sonara's statue. And when her knee had flared with arthritis, she'd left a milagro in the shape of a leg. I couldn't help but wonder if she'd intended her finger to be the ultimate milagro. I skirted the back of the church and headed along a tree-lined avenue toward the monastery reception center near the abbey entrance. It looked like a small cottage. The porch had a sloping roof and was draped with browned honeysuckle. Inside was a monk with a bald head and uncivilized eyebrows that curled over a pair of black glasses. He nodded as I moved past him to a room the monks called the gift shop. I browsed through the displays of cast nets, turned a squeaky rack of rosaries and saints' medals. Spotting a stack of teal-green booklets, I picked one up, surprised to see it was the booklet Cat said she'd had printed, The Mermaid's Tale. I flipped it open to the first page. According to the legend recounted in Legenda Aurea, Readings on the Saints, in 1450, a beautiful Celtic mermaid named Asinora swam ashore on the coast of Cornwall, where a Benedictine monastery had recently been established. After removing her fishtail and hiding it among the rocks, she explored the area on foot and discovered the community of men. She made many clandestine visits.
"It's the story behind our mermaid chair," a voice said, and I looked up from the passage to see the bald monk with his arms crossed tightly over his chest, as if he were battening himself down. He wore a large wooden cross around his neck, and there were droop lines at the corners of his mouth.
"One of our monks wrote it. Pretty fanciful stuff, I'm afraid."
"Yes, I've always loved the story," I told him, realizing I hadn't heard it in ages. Most of it was fuzzy to me now.
"If you're here for the guided tour, I'm afraid you've just missed it, and there's not another one until 3 o'clock this afternoon, though, quite honestly, I don't see the big attraction. Just a lot of, here's the church where the monks pray, and here's the net house where the monks tie nets, and over there is the laundry where the monks wash their socks."
I thought he meant this to be funny, but when I laughed, he glowered at me a little. "No," I said, "I didn't come for the tour. I dug around in my jeans pocket for the $10 bill I'd stuffed inside it and bought the book.
"The author, Father Dominic, where could I find him?" I said. "I'd like to have him sign this for me."
"Sign the book?" He shook his head. "We won't be able to live with him if he starts autographing books. We can barely live with him now."
Again, I wasn't sure whether he was being serious. He had that kind of sour way that made it hard to tell.
"I imagine he's in the library somewhere," he said. "That would be the white stucco building next to the church. It's open to visitors, but some areas aren't. You'd be surprised where people end up. Yesterday a lady came wandering through the refectory while we were eating lunch. She took a picture of the salad bar."
A woman roaming through prohibited areas struck me as amusing, as did his offense at it. But actually more amusing was the fact that the Abbey had a salad bar. I wondered if Mother had come up with that. It was so implausibly current of her. "I know the places that are off limits," I told him. "My mother is Nell Dubois. I'm Jessie. I used to come here as a child." I don't know what made me tell him this. He wasn't the most welcoming person. I was even thinking how peculiar that he, of all the monks, would get assigned to the reception center. Perhaps it was part of a conspiracy to discourage visitors.
He said, "We're sorry about her troubles."
It came out like an automated recording on an answering machine. "And you are?"
"Oh, sorry. I'm Father Sebastian. I'm the prior here."
I tried to remember the monastic hierarchy. I was pretty sure the prior was the second in command, the one who, as Mother put it, kept the monastery on the straight and narrow. Strolling to the library to find Father Dominic, I got a monumental case of cold feet. What am I doing? My steps slowed until I was just standing there, stymied with doubt. I considered going back to the house and calling Hugh. On second thought, "You come fix Mother," I'd say. I do not have the balls, or the ovaries, or whatever anatomical part is required. Glancing behind the church, I noticed the foot trail that led to the edge of the marsh. I followed it to a stone bench that sat beneath an oak. Coward. I didn't sit on the bench, but instead plopped on the ground and sat there staring at the creek plated with mist, the way it moved like a living vein, dog-legging into the bay. I'd often come to this spot after my father died, the times I'd felt sad or lost. I'd shouted my name across the marsh, listening to the way it was magnified over the water, as if the Spartina grasses were singing it, and how sometimes the wind would hoist it like a gull out toward the ocean. "Jessie!" I would call, over and over and over. I was holding the booklet I'd bought and opened it to the passage I'd been reading when Father Sebastian interrupted me. Suspicious that Asinora was no ordinary woman, but a mermaid, and greatly alarmed by her presence, the abbot of the monastery hid himself by the water and waited. He witnessed Asinora swim ashore, remove her fishtail, and hide it in a niche in the cliff. When she wandered off in the direction of the abbey, the shrewd abbot retrieved the fishtail, bundling it into his robe. He tucked it inside a secret compartment hidden under the seat of his chair in the church. Without her tail, the poor mermaid could never go back to the sea. And soon the wildness of it drained out of her. Asinora was converted and eventually became Saint Sinara. When my father used to tell me that part of the story, he talked about Asinora's tragic fate. Losing her tail and getting stuck with a halo. And I got the impression, though it was only reading between the lines, that Dominic felt the same way. And frankly, something about Father Dominic's writing this story at all caused an uneasiness in me. An interesting footnote to the legend states that after her conversion, Asinora sometimes missed the sea and her former life so strongly that she prowled the monastery at night in search of her tale. Conflicting stories exist about whether she ever found it. One story suggests she not only found her fishtail, but donned it whenever she wanted to revisit her lost life, always returning, however, and replacing it inside the abbot's chair. I thought of Mother and her crazy love for Saint Sonara, and I couldn't reconcile it with what I was reading. Sonara was a saint who sneaked around looking for transportation back to her nefarious past. It had never really occurred to me how incongruous this was. Some scholars suggest that the story of Saint Sonara may have been created to help people choose the path of godly delight over that of sensual delight. But might it also be a way of emphasizing the importance of both? Both? I hadn't expected him to write something like that, being a monk. I closed the booklet, sort of slapped it shut, to tell the truth. The tension was vibrating again in my chest. Dampness from the grass had seeped through my jeans. I got to my feet, and when I turned around, I saw Father Dominic coming along the path toward me. He stopped on the other side of the stone bench. He was wearing the straw hat, and Cat had been right. Whole sections of it had sprung loose. It was taking on the farcical appearance of a bird's nest. "Knock, knock," he said, his eyes filled with amusement. I hesitated. So, he remembers me. "Who's there?" I felt immensely awkward saying it, but I didn't see how I could not play along. "Zoom." "Zoom who?" "Zoom did you expect?" he said, setting loose an opulent laugh that seemed oversized for the joke. "I don't think I've seen you since you were a girl. I hope you remember me." "Of course, Father Dominic," I said. I was just..."
"You were just reading my little book, and from the way you closed it, I'm not sure you liked it very much."
He laughed to let me know he was teasing, but it made me uncomfortable. "No, no, I liked it." Neither of us spoke for a moment. I looked off at the marsh, embarrassed. The tide was receding, leaving plats of mud that looked tender and freshly peeled. I could see the holes of dozens of hibernating fiddler crabs, the tip ends of their claws barely protruding.
"Father Sebastian said you were looking for me. I believe you are in need of an autograph for your book."
"Oh, yes, that's right. Would you mind?" I handed him the booklet, feeling caught in my little lie. "I'm sorry, I don't have a pen." He produced one from inside his black scapular. He scrawled something on the inside cover, then handed it back. He said, "This is a lovely spot, isn't it?" "Yes, lovely." The sea of grass behind us swayed with breezes, and he shifted side to side beneath his robe as if he were one of them, a grass blade trying to get synchronized with the rest.
"So, how's our Nell?" he asked.
The question startled me. The curious way he'd said, "Our Nell," plus something in his voice, how her name came out softer than the other words. "Our Nell, our." "Her hand is healing," I said. "The real problem is in here." I meant to touch my finger to my forehead, but involuntarily tapped the flat bone over my heart, and I felt the rightness of that, as though my finger were trying to tell me something.
"Yes, I suppose the heart will cause us to do strange and wondrous things," Father Dominic said.
He rapped his knuckles on his chest, and I had the feeling he was talking about impulses in his own heart. He'd taken off his hat and was plucking at the wayward pieces on it. I had a memory of him that day the monks delivered the washed-up debris from my father's boat, how he'd stood at the fireplace in this very same posture, holding his hat, watching the board burn. "Did you know she called the finger that she cut off her pointing finger?" I asked. He shook his head, and his face, such an old, kind face, changed a little, tightening and puckering in places. I hesitated. Certain things were occurring to me in the moment, guesses, impressions, and
I didn't know whether I should say them. What if she cut it off to relieve a terrible sense of blame? He looked away from my face. He knows. A ravine of quiet opened between us. I remember a murmurous hum rising up like the swell of insects. It seemed to last a long time. Why did she do it? I said. He pretended I was being rhetorical.
Yes, why indeed?
No, I'm asking you. Why did she do it?
Has your mother said something to make you think I would know her motives?
She said she couldn't talk about her reasons. He sighed, laced and unlaced his fingers. I was sure he was making a decision of some kind.
Jessie, I can only imagine how confusing this must be to you, but I can't tell you anything. I wish I could, but I can't.
Did she tell you something during confession? This seemed to catch him off guard, as if such a thing hadn't occurred to him. He leaned toward me, wearing a gentle, knowing look, as if inviting a moment of intimacy between us. I thought for a second he might take my hand.
All I'm saying is that maybe it wouldn't be good for your mother if we delved into it. I know that's just the opposite of what you might think. We've been brainwashed these days to believe we have to dig up every pitiable shred of our past and examine it half to death, but that doesn't always turn out best for a person. Nell wants to keep whatever this is to herself. Maybe we should let her.
He pressed his lips together, and his face looked pained, pleading.
Jessie, I need you to trust me. Trust your mother.
I was about to argue with him when he reached out and, cupping my cheek with his hand, smiled in an austere, resigned way. I don't know why, but I didn't pull away. And we stayed like that a moment before he turned and walked back toward the church, arranging his ragged hat on his head. Chapter 14. I sat on the bench with my back to the marsh and waited until Father Dominic was out of sight. What just happened? He seemed so genuine, earnest.
Jessie, I need you to trust me.
It seemed as if I should. He was, after all, an old monk who told knock-knock jokes. Everyone loved him. More to the point, Cat trusted him. And Cat Bowers was no fool. It would be impossible to dupe that woman. Confused, I stretched my neck backward, watching two ospreys lap a wide circle through the fog. What if Father Dominic was right? Could I make things worse for Mother by trying to understand her reasons? My eyes fell on the mermaid's tail, wedged next to me on the bench. I thumbed to the title page.
"Zoom did you expect?" he'd written in peculiar slanted letters, then scrawled his name.
As I stared at it, it slowly dawned on me. I didn't trust him. I just didn't. I believed inside that I should, and there were Cat and Mother up to their earlobes in trust for Dominic, but I couldn't muster any of it for myself. I glanced at my watch. It was just after 11. I would have to get back soon and fix lunch for Mother, but I had a sudden impulse to slip inside the church and see the mermaid chair. The last time I'd seen it had probably been 25 years ago, right before I'd left for college. Despite the considerable time Mike and I had spent horsing around on it as children, I always associated it with my father. I suppose because he was the one who'd first showed it to me, who'd told me the story behind it, who loved the chair nearly as much as his boat. Mother, on the other hand, had wanted nothing to do with it. It hadn't always been that way. Up until Dad died, she hadn't minded the chair at all. Year after year, he'd been one of the men who carried the mermaid chair on its 2-mile procession, from the church to the ferry dock, for the blessing of the fleet, something she'd encouraged. Typically, the monks chose the more pious men, and Joe Dubois had been an absolute pagan. But somehow, he'd always wheedled himself into the job. He simply believed, he said, in blessing shrimp boats. He didn't care whether it was Saint Sonara, God, the monks, or Max the dog who performed the blessing. But I think it was more than that. While my mother loved Sonara, the saint, my father loved her other nature, her life as Asinora, the mermaid. The chair had round iron hooks on each arm for poles to slip through, and every April, early in the evening of St. Sonara's feast day, four men lifted the rods onto their shoulders and paraded the chair from the church, through the abbey gate, past the island shops, as if it were Cleopatra's throne or the bier of a Greek god. I remember Mike and me marching beside our father the whole way, very brash and self-important. Peacocked, Mother had said. And the islanders flowing out behind us, undulating over the road in a long bridal train of color. Walking now toward the church, I thought about those radiant processions. The prayer read by the abbot as he sat in the mermaid chair on the dock's edge, his hand lifted in blessing. And perhaps 40 trawlers, not just from Egret Island, but McClellanville and Mount Pleasant, too, moving past the dock, each one strung with colored lights, the water turning molten as darkness collected. After the boats were blessed and the chair ceremoniously splashed with seawater, the islanders would toss mermaid tears, tiny pearl-colored pebbles, into the bay as a way of honoring the mermaid saint's sadness at leaving the ocean. Then the entire island would gather around tables of fried and boiled shrimp at Max's Cafe. Between the net house and the church, there was a grassy area where the monks used to spread the cast nets on wooden racks and treat them with a coppery-smelling solution to keep them from rotting. The racks were gone now, but I could see a robed monk out there tossing a bright yellow tennis ball to Max. His back was to me, but I noticed he was tall and that his hair was dark. When Max bounded back to him with the ball, the monk bent down and rubbed the dog's head. It was Brother Thomas. As I walked toward him, he turned, and when he recognized me, his face filled with what looked exactly like pleasure. He came over to me, holding the tennis ball, Max trailing behind. "I didn't mean to interrupt your game," I said, trying not to smile for some reason, but I couldn't restrain it. I felt a lavish sweep of happiness at the sight of him.
"I was just passing time with Max until day prayer and Mass," he said.
There was a moment of silence in which I looked off at the trees, then back to find him watching me with the faintest accumulation of a smile. I thought of my dream, the two of us on the raft in the ocean. The images had come to me repeatedly over the last 2 days, his cowl falling back to reveal his face, his hand touching my cheek, sliding beneath my back. I felt self-conscious thinking about it in his presence, as if it might show through. I abruptly dropped my gaze to the ground, where I saw his boots sticking out from beneath his robe, caked with dry mud from the marsh.
"My work shoes," he said. "I'm the rookery monk."
"The what?"
He laughed. "The rookery monk," he repeated.
"And what is that?"
"The state pays us to take care of the rookery. It's a protected refuge, so one of us is designated to go out every day and keep an eye on it."
"You don't make cast nets with the others?"
"No, thank God. I was terrible at it. Plus, I'm the youngest one here, so I got the outdoor job."
Max had been sitting patiently waiting.
"One more," Thomas told him, and sent the ball sailing into the air.
We watched Max for a second as he ran full speed through the haze. "What does a rookery monk do, exactly?" I asked.
"He keeps track of the bird population. Not just egrets, but pelicans, herons, ospreys, most all of them. In the spring and summer, he counts and measures egret eggs, checks on the nests, the hatchlings, that kind of thing. This time of year is not so busy."
I could smell a fragrance coming from him. It was, I realized, grape jelly. "So you watch birds?" He smiled. That's the biggest part of it. But I do other things. Inspect the oyster beds, collect water samples, whatever's needed. The Department of Natural Resources has a checklist for me. Max came bounding up with a ball in his mouth, and Thomas took it, tucking it inside his scapular.
Max usually goes out in the boat with me, he added, stroking the dog's back.
I can tell you like the job, I said.
To be honest, I think sometimes being out there on the creeks is what keeps me here.
I know what you mean. I grew up on the creeks. My brother and I loved the birds. We used to go out in the rookery and watch the male egrets do their mating dance. I'd blurted this without thinking. And it would have been nothing, nothing, just stupid conversation about birds if, realizing what I'd said, I hadn't drawn in my breath, making that small, rasping sound of surprise. Redness washed up my neck into my cheeks, so of course he knew I was reading something sexual into what we were doing. I wanted to turn and run off the way Max had done. He was looking at me intently. I'm sure he knew what I was thinking. But he was kind, and he tried to smooth it over. He said,
Yes, I've seen it many times. It's beautiful the way they snap their bills and elongate their necks. The truth was, I'd been snapping my bill and elongating my neck for the last 5 minutes.
I've told you what I do, he was saying. What is it you do? I stood there, trying to make myself appear very straight and proper. I didn't know how to say who I was or what I did.
What did I do?
Keep house for Hugh? Paint scenes in little boxes and arrange a collage of objects inside them? No, I couldn't even claim that anymore. And Dee had grown up and gone away, so I couldn't say, I'm a stay-at-home mom, in that cheerful way I used to. I said, You know, I was really on my way to see the mermaid chair. I shouldn't keep you.
You're not keeping me at all.
Come on, I'll walk you over there, unless you want to be alone.
All right, I said.
I knew he detected the change in my demeanor, and I didn't know why he was being persistent. Did he want to be with me, or was he merely being hospitable? He touched my elbow, guiding me onto the path that led around to the church, the same small, common gesture he'd used with Mother. But the pressure of his hand on my coat sent a current flying through me. The church was deserted, filled with a throbbing silence. We eased along the nave between the choir stalls, moving past the altar into the narrow ambulatory behind the apse, where we paused at the arched entrance to a tiny chapel. The mermaid chair sat on a raised platform that was carpeted in a dark wine color. The carpet, I noticed, had thinned down to patches of thread in several places. On the wall behind the chair, a narrow clerestory window let in a stripe of musty sawdust light that fell across the seat. I walked over and laid my hand on the back of the chair. It was carved with an intricate Celtic knot design. The mermaids that made up the chair arms were still painted in green, gold, and red, though some of the brightness had faded since I'd seen them last. I hadn't thought the sight of it would affect me, but my eyes welled up immediately. My father had sat on the chair and patted his knee for me to climb into his lap. Laying my cheek against the rough corduroy of his jacket, I'd whispered to him, "Are you praying?" Because that's what you did when you sat in the chair. You prayed for things, usually impossible things, and your prayers were supposed to be answered. Before Mother had acquired her odd aversion to the chair, she used to sing a verse to me, a rhyme every child on the island knew by heart. Sit in the chair, say a prayer, an answer tomorrow from Saint Sanara. My father had whispered back, Yes, I'm praying, but don't you dare tell your mother. I'll never hear the end of it.
What are you praying for?
For you.
I'd sat up, electrified by this. My father was saying a prayer for me. And whatever he asked, it would happen.
What are you asking?
He touched the tip of his finger to my nose. That you'll stay my whirligirl forever. I noticed Brother Thomas still in the entranceway, looking uncertain about whether to stay or to leave me alone. I let my hand glide over the wooden locks of the mermaid's hair, then along her wings. I always wondered why she has wings, I said. I never heard of mermaids having them. Do you know why? He took it as an invitation, which it was, and came to the other side of the chair, stepping into the dim, powdery light from the window. It made a streak on his robe.
The thinking around here is that she's part siren. Sirens have fish tails and wings.
Her wings reminded me suddenly of plumage, of mating dances. But I thought sirens were terrible creatures.
You're probably thinking of the Odyssey, how they lured the sailors onto the rocks, but before that they were sea goddesses. They brought messages from the deep, kind of like angels, but they didn't come down from heaven, they came up from the sea. Supposedly their messages would inspire or heal. So sirens weren't always bad.
I must have looked surprised that he knew so much about it, because he grinned slightly and said,
I fill in for Brother Bede sometimes. He's the one who leads the guided tours.
I heard a shuffling noise in the corridor just outside the chapel and looked around, expecting to see a monk step in, but no one did. And we went on talking a few more minutes about the mermaids on the chair. He told me he liked the idea of them having both wings and fishtails, because it meant they could carry on in two completely different worlds, that they belonged equally to the sky and sea. And he envied that. He talked at length about it, but I didn't find it high-minded, only intriguing. And to be honest, it excited me that he possessed this kind of arcane knowledge. I let my gaze travel to the chair arm again, pretending to be engrossed in the mermaid, the whole wing-fish-tail conundrum, aware that he was still looking at me.
Do you believe the story that anyone who sits in the chair and prays will be granted an answer? I asked.
Not in the magical sense, no.
I take it you don't sit in the chair like the tourists and pray.
I suppose I pray in other ways.
What ways? I asked, realizing after I'd said it how intrusive it sounded. I was sure I'd never asked anyone about his prayer life before. Thomas Merton wrote that the birds were his prayers, and I guess I feel that way too. I pray best by just being out in the marsh. It's the only praying my soul seems to really respond to. Soul. The word rebounded to me. And I wondered, as I often had, what it was exactly. People talked about it all the time, but did anybody actually know? Sometimes I'd pictured it like a pilot light burning inside a person, a drop of fire from the invisible inferno people called God. Or a squashy substance, like a piece of clay or dental mold, which collected the sum of a person's experiences. A million indentations of happiness, desperation, fear, all the small piercings of beauty we've ever known. I might have asked him about it, but a bell began to ring in the belfry overhead. He stepped into the corridor, then turned back to me, and I could see the sharp blue in his eyes, even from over there.
I don't pray in the mermaid chair, but, for the record, that doesn't mean it lacks power.
The bell clanged again. Smiling at me, he tucked his hands into his scapular with Max's tennis ball and walked away.